Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Matthew Byers. Byers is a member of the Washington, D.C. band The Caribbean, as well as the creative mind behind Attorneys General, a project which finds him collaborating with groups of 3 to 4 musicians who improvise sound, which is sent through a mixing board that Byers controls, allowing him to, in his words, capture, loop, manipulate, and destroy sounds they create. There are 3 new Attorneys General releases out now, with sounds captured in Japan and England. We discuss those, the nature of improvisation, and Byers' role in the annual Stanine Festival in Washington, D.C., which is held at the home of the nonprofit group Rhizome D.C. The festival's 2026 lineup is now over, with eyes cast toward future festivals. That's Matthew Byers of Attorneys General on Into Music coming up now. You know, there's a lot of music to talk about here, and I was kind of strategizing, like, how we should go about this in terms of these 3 releases, if my math is correct.
Yeah, you're right.
So I guess maybe, you know, we can, if you just want to go through them kind of one by one or something and talk, for instance, first of all, about this record that was recorded in Tokyo.
Yeah, it was recorded, yes, in Tokyo at a venue called Aftari, which is a basement space in Tokyo. And I was really lucky to be able to make a connection there. A woman named Eliko Suzuki, who I know through David Grubbs, who I did a record with and who's a friend, lives there. And then she recruited Tetsuji Akiyama, who is semi-legendary in noise experimental circles, going back to all sorts of projects you might be familiar with that I won't list here, but Heiji Kano, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, lots of noise things going back decades. So yeah, connected, and it's always interesting with Attorneys General. People are generally interested in taking part. I've never actually been a player in one of these myself, of course, because I'm the one sort of obviously controlling the processing and turning the knobs and everything. But people are always eager to jump in. And I suppose some of that is just finding the right folks who are adventurous and want to try things and improvise things and see what happens. Obviously, they're often improvisers themselves, already improvisers in many, if not most cases. But there's a lot of yes, and, as they say in the improv, you know, comedy world, at least. So that was how I connected with them. I was going over to Japan anyway on a family trip, and I like to combine the, business with pleasure or pleasure with business. I'm not sure which one is which. But, it was fortuitous. And I really liked that venue. Again, like so many venues, I had heard of it many times, so its reputation sort of preceded it. But it, you know, it's a modest place when you get in. But if you're not familiar with it, if somebody's not familiar who's listening, they're a label and obviously a venue. It's a very small sort of black box, as I mentioned, in the basement of a apartment building, and they have their entire catalog for sale there and CDs and cassettes and everything else. So it's really cool. So that's how that came together.
I always love thinking about kind of, you know, these spaces that experimental music happens in and like how often they just seem like such normal, you know, kind of spaces from the outside. And sometimes I wonder if people are like, you know, if they really found out what was going on in those walls.
For sure. It occurs to me too. And in that case in particular, I said apartment building. I think I really meant office building, which is even more interesting because it's so nondescript. And it's this, I don't know if you've been to Japan or know, at least have a picture in your head of what it's like. You know, it's very densely populated, and there's all sorts of tiny little places, businesses, sometimes karaoke bars, you know, whatever, regular bars, restaurants, this that are like 1/20th of the size that we might have in the U.S. But as a result, there's so many more of them. And yeah, it's very hard to know what's going on in each one of those or any of them for that matter. You might not even notice them when you walk by. And this is especially the case because I got dropped off actually by my Lyft driver, and it was just an adventure trying to find where it was because it's not heavily marked or anything. But yeah, you get on these stairs and you find it, and there's a lot of art. There's a lot of things going on, and people are very committed to what they do. So it's pretty neat.
So when you walk into a situation like that, there's kind of the call, you know, hey, we should collaborate and so forth. But from there, how much discussion happens beforehand?
Well, interesting question in terms of the Tokyo record, because the language barrier is significant. Both Eliko and Tatuzi speak English, but I mean, and quite well for non-native speakers. But there's, you know, especially in the written version, it was a challenge to make sure they understood how this worked, because there is a concept, right? Where people have whatever instrument they have and they send me a 1/4-inch line or whatever, and I plug it into my, you know, effects unit, gear, mixer, everything else, and we improvise. And in some ways, that's a simple concept. But of course, if you add in that complexity of translating to another language, I wasn't 100% sure at times that they understood exactly what I was talking about. We got there, and I think, but it took a little more doing than it usually does without the language barrier.
Well, and I assume that sometimes even working with somebody who's a native speaker, there still might be those moments of like, what exactly is this?
For sure. And there was an advantage in the sense that, again, she had been in an, actually, I forgot this. She had been in an Attorney's General show I did in New York with David Grubbs and Ian Williams and Riley Walker. And so that's actually how I tracked who she was. So I guess she had seen it in action. It's only now it's occurring to me that she had seen this in action. So maybe I didn't have to worry about actually explaining things that much. But again, the language barrier presents issues for sure.
So you're ideally walking into the situation feeling like something's going to come out of this. We hope it works, right? Which is the great unknown with improvisation.
Right.
So what is that like in that process as you're listening and thinking? Are you even thinking about, is this working, or do you just let it happen and then kind of review later?
No, a review in the moment. I think the key thing for me has been just absolutely being free of judgment, my own judgment, and being sensitive to others as it happens. It's just being completely laid bare and having no ego involved whatsoever, which was something that I had to work to do, but I think I did it both consciously and unconsciously. I knew I needed to uncouple myself from that thing that I've been a part of for a long time of being in a band and going back quite a ways in a band where, you know, for a lot of it, you're playing in regular clubs and you're like, how's this going over? And you're worried about this and like, oh, we didn't play well. And all these things that just sort of plague you. And I couldn't control any of that. And I consciously, as I said, and also again, there was a little bit of unconscious thought in the sense that I knew I kind of needed to do that for this to be truly rewarding and free. Is just turn off all that. And I'm able to do that. I think some of it actually comes out of being a teacher for years and having literally taught, and I'm not exaggerating when I say tens of thousands of classes, where it's the same thing. The way I approach things, there's sort of a premise or a challenge or something that I present or an idea that I'm trying to impart, of course, But then I leave a lot to chance about how the audience, quote unquote, is going to respond to that. And I think over years that really lent itself to exactly what attorneys general is, because it's just reading the moment and making decisions and making a lot of them very quickly and anticipating things and knowing when you hit a dead end, like you got to go somewhere else. And then you can also anticipate dead ends, potential dead ends, but also not being afraid of them. Like it's okay. With setting up the recording for each of these three records, I didn't think I'm going to record these and put them out. I thought I'll record it. And if there's good stuff here, then I'll possibly put it out. But there was no expectation or pressure for it to be this, that, or the other. As soon as that exists, I think, you know, you're setting your own trap. You know, you're self-conscious and you're pushing things in the wrong way or pushing things at all when you should just be letting them happen. I used that improv term earlier, you know, of improv comedy, yes, and. And it really is that, just being open to ideas and taking chances, not worrying about if you fall flat in your face. And if you do fall flat in your face, not feeling bad about it, not being embarrassed or ashamed. It's important. And I think it makes a difference in the work.
Is it, because I've taught for many years myself, and isn't it interesting how you can present something at, I'll present something to a class at 9:30 and maybe I'll land or it won't, right? And then I go to the class at 11 o'clock, and whatever landed at 9:30, 11 o'clock doesn't want to know about it.
100%. Yeah, absolutely. And I found out that's how you get really good as a teacher, too, that I might have had when I was still more in the classroom, had four of the same class in a day. I almost always did. So I get four reps at the exact same thing. It was like playing four sets. And you start to anticipate things, you take other chances, make other choices, but the audience changes. And we're talking about middle school kids, so it also, time of day is a huge factor. It is for every human being, but especially kids. So yeah, you can't predict how it's going to play out. You really can't. Although it's interesting, again, to draw that parallel with teaching, I can now ensure a certain level of quality, quote unquote, to come out of it because I've done it so many times. And as I've gotten better, again, quote unquote, that's highly subjective, but my version of better with attorneys general, yeah, I can usually salvage something from something that maybe, you know, things aren't sparking, but I can find a way. And there's almost always a point in the set, almost always, where I'm like, boom, got it. That's the part right there. It might have taken us 10 minutes or 15 or 20 to get there, but I'm like, okay, that's worth it. That's cool. And that's always gratifying. And there are those moments before that, where as much as I talked about being fearless and not worrying about it or judging, there's still those little specters in your head sometimes, just briefly, that I know how to quell. But like, oh my God, this isn't happening at all. Like, what am I doing? And this isn't working. And it's very brief, but they're still there. So it's nice when you do reach that point, you're like, boom, this worked. And on all three of these records, I think especially, actually a little also with Tokyo, because we played two sets. This was the second set and the better of the two, obviously, since I put it out. But with the other two I put out, which is, if it's okay to go ahead and jump to those, one I did in London with a couple guys from a band called Caroline. It's a rough trade band, Mike O'Malley and Alex McKenzie, and then a woman named Tara Cunningham, who's in a band called Modern Nature, or something else called, I think, The Sleeves. She's an improviser. They're all improvisers at heart. And that one happened much faster, in the sense that early on I'm like, okay, cool, we're getting somewhere with this. And I've played with them before, so I kind of knew that probably something would get. They're very, very good at listening to each other. That one really clicked. And then the other was done in Birmingham, UK, with a saxophonist and an electronics person named Mark Hanslip, and then a free jazz drummer named Mark Sanders, who's really well known over there and plays with John Butcher and a lot of esteemed folks. Just recently did a residency, a week-long residency at Cafe Otto. He's been playing for years. And that was the same one, I think, right from the get-go. And I think if you listen to that recording in particular, the Birmingham one captured right off the bat. Because Mark Sanders is such a brilliant improviser, and he's a drummer, but he's drums have very little to do with it. He's not, you know, he's making sounds with drums. And he started off in such a patient way of doing something really interesting with cymbals that I sampled and then looped. And it just worked instantly, I think. And it was also a theme that became recurring through the entire set. I kept coming back to on one of my sample pedals. So yeah, whatever question was asked, that's the end of my answer. I don't remember where we started.
Well, you mentioned this idea too, in being in the process and not judging it. But I think people who are going to listen to improvised music also have that thing that clicks in. I know I do, where it's like, okay, this is not listening to a pop single, so I'm going to give it more time. I'm going to let it unfold. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. at some point, the big picture is going to come into view.
Right. Well, and what I hope people hear is, like a lot of improv, you hear a conversation, you hear choices being made. And I think the concept is kind of important. I've played with David Grubbs more than a few times in this. And one of the last times we played, I was like, oh, I got to explain. I always like to do a preamble, explain what's happening, like what the concept is. He's like, I don't worry about it. And I haven't done it since. And I'm not sure if it's good or bad. I thought it was interesting that he had that insight. Or I also think he just wanted to get going and didn't want me to talk anymore. So that's okay too. But I'm often a conceptual person with this kind of thing. I like the notion of people knowing that there are limitations, right? And I think it's interesting. The limitations are what's hugely interesting about it, because also I used to say in my preamble, like, I'm using sort of over the counter technology here. This is not like, I'm not using like Ableton or something. There's not a laptop. That suddenly becomes much less interesting to me. And that doesn't mean that I'm not interested in music that uses that or sounds that use that. But for me, these are like, you know, there's some esoteric guitar pedals in here for sure, but in my gear, but you know, you're pretty limited. I'm just using stomp boxes that, you know, I'm hitting with my fist instead. And it doesn't mean that I don't kind of carefully choose those and get interesting things out of them. But the limitation is really, I think, interesting. And I think for me, it's, at least as a listener, I like to know the limitations that people had with what, when they were creating whatever they created. And if the limitations are, if there are no limitations, if it's unlimited, far less interesting to me. It's not that it always is less interesting, but it usually is. So yeah, to jump off a cliff with some other people, and often I do this in several different iterations in terms of how the sound runs through my gear, but the sort of hard concept that I stuck to very religiously early was that everything goes through me, and I control volume. I control when you're being heard and when you're not, which I do like, because that's the sort of instant composing part for me, where I do feel there should be more silence. It should be quieter. It should be this. It should be that. But then for whatever reason, there's also a version I do where people, I'm grabbing their signal, but they're also playing their own signal at the same time. So I'm more of I'm adding on rather than simply, rather than controlling the entire thing. I don't know. I think that presents interesting challenges too. But again, as a listener, I've always loved to know about context and who are these people? When was this and what was going on around this? When I did college radio years and years ago, going on the air and giving a bunch of context about, I don't know, it was like Dump Truck or something. I don't even know if you know I'm talking about, that band from Boston, I think. And I was getting all this backstory about Dump Truck and then, you know, getting shut out by their record label. I don't know how much you remember about any of this stuff, but like, this is like college rock lore from like 1989. Anyway, I'm given all this context and I go to the song and this friend comes in who'd been listening and he's like, man, no one cares about that stuff, which is such, you know, and he didn't for sure. And I also think it just illustrated to me that I do. I want to know, like, because it's not that hard for anyone to make music. I want to know what, like, who you are, like, what do you bring into this? What's the context? Where are you coming from? Give some local flavor to this, something to give for me to grab onto. Because there's so much music that sounds exactly the same. I want something to make it interesting and make me care.
So when you're collaborating with somebody, and obviously you have some familiarity, but is part of this also like not being too familiar? Like, I'll just take Riley Walker, who of course is, you know, great improviser, but does different things in improvisation. I imagine you don't want to walk in thinking like, okay, I know this guy's game. I know what's going to happen, right?
No, I mean, I've been repeat players where I have a general sense of how they operate, but most of the folks that I even have that notion with are going to try to surprise themselves, so they're going to surprise me too. And they're not doing the same thing over and over again, as you're kind of getting at. That's part of the deal. I think people are interested in this kind of thing, are trying to keep themselves, find interesting things. You know, they want to hear new sounds. They want things to be unexpected. They want, they're looking for something different, either as a listener and definitely as a player, you know, because chance is where that comes from. And just taking chances, taking risks. And it's funny because I didn't have a sense with Riley. Riley is a chameleon in the sense that he puts out these gorgeous, you know, acoustic records or like, you know, entire records that sound like Van Morrison. And then like, he's also dabbles in the harsh noise world and improvised things. And he touches all of it without ever not being himself, which I think is a really cool thing. And he came into this and I didn't have any expectation really, but he just picked up a guitar that was in this space at this anarchist bookstore we were playing at called The Pit in Brooklyn. And there was some sort of like teardrop shaped guitar that had a built-in drum machine, like a really crappy, like, and you can hear it briefly, like, I think, you know, the middle of the second side of that release of him turning it on briefly. And it's just ridiculous. So whatever he sounds like, I don't know, but he didn't sound like it that day at all. He just went with it. And that's, of course, what improvisers do, you know. He was definitely reading the room. That's key as well.
Now, you've been doing this Rhizome Festival for how long now?
I always lose track. I think it's been about 8 years with a year off for COVID, or nine with a year off for COVID. Yeah, it's called Seventh Stay Nine over at Rhizome.
Okay. And this functions in kind of a similar terrain?
Yeah. It's a lot of the same folks. And it was really, it's my band, The Caribbean, which is a trio. We really curate it. And that's my main thing. Attorneys General is sort of obviously a little bit of a side thing for me. But we put that together, and it's a way of connecting with people we like and admire. Like anything, it's a creative process to curate it. The curation is the fun part, seeing who you want to have, who you can get, how it pieces together. But that is, that's something we've been doing for a while now.
I mean, and it seems like obviously you've got people coming from all over the country to play. You're probably attracting people, the audience, in a similar way, and probably seeing it grow with each year a little bit.
Yeah, there is some of that. I mean, honestly, like, you're involved in similar things. It's promoting things is hard. It's really hard. And it's always been hard. And what used to be hard is that there would be one or two outlets that you'd need for coverage. And it was up to them whether they covered you or not. I mean, these would be the alt weeklies, or maybe the local newspaper when they still had an arts section, like the Washington Post did, like last year, covered us in print and covered us online. And then they fired their pop music critic, Chris Richards, and also one of their features editors. And they have no more music coverage or arts coverage. So as a result, it's like everything else. It all comes down to social media. And it is a lift. Because I used to just go, I'd post about one of the artists or the festival and be, all right, I'm all done. I posted on social media. And then you realize, like, who actually sees that out of all these people who might be interested, and how do you reach them without jamming some sort of ad down their throat all the time, which is always kind of cheesy. So honestly, the promotion is hard. I think that there are probably a lot of people who would really appreciate or be interested in it who don't know anything about it. And I've had people tell me that, like, oh my gosh, I didn't even know this was happening. I don't know how else to notify them. You know, I've got my label account. I've got my band account. I've got my Attorneys General account. I have the podcast I do account, you know, and you're putting out everything, and you're doing stories, and you're inviting collaborators, and it makes a difference, and it helps, I'm not saying that it's not, there's no fruits of your labors there, but at the same time, you know, it takes a lot of time, as I'm sure everybody listening knows.
I sometimes wonder about the proliferation of festivals, in that I feel like what you're doing, that to me is like ideal, because that's very much about community as well. You're not just trying to pull from everywhere, right? But I've seen this proliferation of like, well, we'll have a festival and that'll get this group in and that'll get that group in. And somehow it kind of, not to be a gatekeeper, but to me it kind of sullies the notion a little bit, because it becomes less about community and more about enterprise.
Yeah. And I think, I could get myself in trouble for saying this. I think gatekeeping is a little underrated. That being said, it doesn't mean of human beings. It means, but of art, it's okay. Like, I posted something, a phrase I like quite a bit, a few months ago on one of the Instagrams, saying art is about taking sides. And it's like, I think this is cool, and I believe in this. And implied in that is there's a lot of things that I don't think are cool and don't believe in. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason to do it, is that it's the curation part, right? I don't want to equate it to making a mixtape, but it probably comes from the same impulse, right? Like, here's a collection of interesting things that go together in an interesting way. Because I will feel it out, it doesn't take me a year, but I take a long process, because that person would be great. But I'm going to sit and wait how I feel in a couple months. Am I still feeling that at that point, especially based on the other things that I booked? It goes back to the same notion with, you know, improvising. Like, in this moment, what's best next? What comes next? What's best to come next? And I'll get to a certain point, and I'm not trying at all to be all things to all people, but one year I booked a bunch of things I was really psyched about, and I realized the day of the festival, as everybody's playing, like, everybody was, like, really, really very, this sounds like I don't like this kind of thing, as I do, but very, very quiet and very, a little more avant-garde than I'd anticipated. And I love the avant-garde, but it was all kind of that. And it was a little monochromatic as a result. So I paid more attention recently to, like, not even verbally saying, like, oh, I need something that's more this, but just kind of getting a sense of, you know, who they are. Again, going back to the notion of shaping something in the moment or over a period of time into what you would be interesting to you.
You've been listening to a conversation with Matthew Byers of Attorneys General. There are three new Attorneys General releases out now via Headache Journals. You can find out more about them via headachejournals.bandcamp.com. You can learn more about the band The Caribbean via thecaribbean.tumblr.com. The podcast Essential Tremors, hosted by Byers and Lee Gardner, is distributed by NPR and can be found wherever you get your podcasts. You can learn more about this show and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org, and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.